Yearning to play a few rounds of Gwent. That ought to set me straight.
Welcome to Commander's Horn, episode 52. This weekend is the first CD Projekt Red licensed event, Gwent Slam, hosted by Life Coach. The final three players were determined this past weekend in a duo of qualifying tournaments and the top of the pro ladder. Jaggerus is our guest this week, and we're talking all about Scoia'tael, all this, and some good dogs on this episode of Commander's Horn. Oh, hello, friends. Welcome back to Commander's Horn Podcast, your weekly Gwent podcast. I am one of your hosts, Dane McBeard, and I am joined, as always, by the Midnight Viking. Do we still like the Midnight Viking? Have you outgrown Midnight Viking? How do you feel about it these days?
Well, I think the game has moved on from any types of Vikings or pirates in this game. And, Midnight Mahakam Marauder could possibly work.
That's your jam right now? You like the dwarf decks again?
Yeah, I'm way back into the dwarves. Even got the beard to match.
Classic gray boxer, Mahaka Mondays.
It's been fun out there, man. Gwent's been really good to me this week, and it's been a really exciting week again.
Yeah, we got to see, the news hasn't been as explosive, but those qualifying, those golden tickets being handed out to Gwent Slam, they all got handed out this weekend. So we're going to talk about that for sure. Talk about Gwent Slam a little bit if you haven't really heard very much about it. It is the Life Coach hosted Gwent kind of third party licensed event, 10K on the line and crown points for two of these very lucky people, or three, I believe. Actually, three people can earn it. And there's lots to talk about. Plus our guest, Grey Boxer, our guest.
It's Jaggerus, a.k.a. Francesca, from Norway.
Yeah, yeah. So we have a great chat with her, and we talk all about Scoia'tael as well on this episode. So we talk about all the new cards, and we have a nice, good chat with Jaggerus. You know, it was good. It was, like, nice and fluid. We just kind of just talked about the games we've been playing, and we're going to get into that. This episode of Commander's Horn is recorded in the Commander's Horn studio. You can find Commander's Horn on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting apps. Follow us on Twitter at Commander's Horn for all updates about the show. Feel free to tweet at us or email us your feedback to commandershornpodcast@gmail.com.
This episode of Commander's Horn is brought to you by our sponsor, the Nilfgaardian Dictionary. Help your men know the meaning of sacrifice. This episode is supported by our commandos, our patrons at patreon.com. We were just kidding about that Nilfgaardian stuff.
So we're not going to retake it, but there was a guy on Reddit who said that the commandos yelling is something that can be very bone rattling, I guess, with some headphones. So maybe we might do some step back from the mic commandos in the future. I don't know. It's tough. It's so much of what we do. We love to yell and scream.
We're excited. I mean, we have, we've been out here for quite some time, McBeard podcasting, and anyone who's supporting the show is very special to us. And, you know, we talk with them in Discord all the time. And I'm telling you, all the guys who listen in Discord love the shout outs.
Yeah, man. That's right. That's good.
That's right. We're going to double down.
We're going to double down. We're going to say it even louder now. Okay. But there is a little bit of bad news regarding the commandos. I do have to tell you this sad story. So the Commander's Horn Commandos was part of the TGI, the Gwentleman's Invitational Summer League. We did get to the playoffs. We did play our first match in the round of 16, and we were unfortunately taken out by Team SGC. And it was close. It went five games. And we just got beat, you know? We tried our best.
I mean, you guys were finalists. I mean, to be, you know, in the playoffs of the TGI and to take your opponent to five games, hey, I'd be proud of that, especially for the first time trying one of these events. And to take the commandos that far is pretty awesome, in my opinion. So good on you, mate.
I am pretty pleased with our performance overall. And it was a lot of fun, and doing a league-based tournament or league-based play at all, or like co-oping even with somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new kind of format.
I think with the, you said something about the, you know, basically being a team sort of format, and that's true because there isn't anything really like this, and co-oping with friends is really fun, and we've done it a bunch. And you know, I don't know about you, but when I watch streams, I kind of co-op in my mind with the streamer, and sometimes people call that, you know, like backseat piloting. But anyway, it's good.
You're a vocal Twitch audience member, and lots of people like that in their Twitch audience members. So keep doing your thing. But speaking of tournaments and such, there were some very successful tournament players this weekend, Grey Boxer, and I think we should talk about the latest and final qualifiers for the Gwent Slam, which is the big event that's occurring on the 23rd and 24th, live from Vienna. We're going to watch 8 very hopeful players take on each other for a chance to be the first champion of Gwent Slam. Let's talk about that right after this.
So yeah, the Gwent Slam qualifiers were hosted this weekend on Strivewire. There was one on Saturday and one on Sunday? Or was there one on Friday and one on Saturday?
It was, it was Friday and Saturday. Friday, yeah. And then Sunday was the cutoff for the pro ladder. So we did get a little bit of something each day.
Yeah. And so the Strivewire tournaments were Friday and Saturday. And we saw some pretty well-known names getting towards the top here. And, you know, I think that this was a good qualifier. There's tons and tons of participants. I mean, there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 or 300 almost, or I can't even count that high, McBeard.
Yeah, there were a lot of people. They were really, really big tournaments, and you know, it got to the point where like the brackets were so small that a lot of people seemed to get byes in some situations, but it did get all the way down to 2 very, very talented players. The people that won, so the first champion was Freddy Babes of the Gwentleman, UK's Freddy Babes. You probably have seen him stream. He does stream frequently, and he probably also recognizes his name from the top of the ladder because he usually hangs out there. He's a very, very good player. And seeing Freddy Babes get in to the Gwent Slam is really great because, you know, he's already a community member, right? He's already contributing and he's already out there. And Panda, tell me about, you watched Panda qualify. Did you watch Panda qualify?
Yeah, almost for the entire day. And Panda went pretty far on day one as well. I think he made it to like top 16 or top 8. And then he ended up getting through everyone on day 2 and making it to the finals. And I think in the finals, he was up against Raka, who he 3-0'd for the win. And those games were pretty fun to watch. And I just can't imagine the level of like concentration he had going through this, and he was running a movement list that I really liked, and he had Operator in there for the Dwarven Agitators, which I thought was really smart, and because that really enables a lot of play on your side without giving them anything. It's really probably the best Operator play out there. So I like his take on movement, and I like the matches. I like seeing him go so far on 2 days and really just push ahead and qualify. So really, really big congrats to Impetuous Panda. He's my favorite for this event, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we saw him in Gwent Together, I should say, which is sort of like the prequel to the Gwent Slam series that we're going to see. So it was, and you know, there's a really great trailer that was released. If you haven't seen the trailer, going to link it in the show notes and also take a little note for myself. You're going to want to check this tweet out from Life Coach. Had a really great teaser for Gwent Slam, but it was all footage from Gwent Together. So Impetuous Panda is actually in this video as well, going through this the first time. But when I met him, he was, you know, we know him as like a Skellige god, right? Like he's just one of the best players out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's really shown that he's like really kind of matured into all the other factions as well, not just on his pro ladder placement, but being able to compete this well in a tournament. Absolutely fantastic. Will be great to see you again, Panda. And also just want to bring you back to the Freddy Babes championship. He was taking on Grumparis, and he also 3-0'd his opponent. So a little extra show of dominance at the very, very end. These guys were really tired. I don't know about Impetuous Panda, but I know Freddy Babes played for about 11 hours straight.
Yeah, these tournaments are grueling because when there's so many, when it's an open qualifier, everybody who wants to go is going to sign up and then just kind of play through. And even though, you know, some of the folks aren't going to be able to push as far as people like Panda and Freddy, you know, there's going to be a lot of delay waiting for matches. And that was something that I heard from the community, is that there was a good bit of delay in between matches and a lot of waiting around. And that can be mentally exhausting as well, McBeard, kind of building up the apprehension for the next match, not knowing who you're going to play yet, maybe not knowing much about them, and then trying to make sure your decks are in order for that sort of thing and what you want to play first. So, I mean, it could be nerve wracking, not only to play for 11 hours straight, but also the waiting periods in between.
Yeah, for sure. It's just, it takes up your whole day. It takes up everything you think about for that day. It's exhausting. Even just the waiting is exhausting for tournaments. So, it really takes like a lot of preparation, and you don't want to invest this kind of time just to drop it in the finals either. Like the amount of practice that leads up to tournaments as well. Like it's just hours and hours upon just the day that you play, and just maintaining, just staying sharp as well. Like I think it's just a lot of stuff doesn't get enough credit. Like winning looks great, but everything behind winning is just a mountain of work. So congratulations to these guys. It's really great to see players like this get in. Impetuous Panda also writes for GwentDB as well as streams himself, also very, very frequently at the top of the ladder. Saw him at Gwent Together as well. So these are really great players, really great kind of pieces of the community that earned their way to in there as well. So it's just the people you really want to see. And then there was a final seat granted on Sunday, a player known as Adzikov from Poland. Currently, I mean, the cutoff has already come and gone, but it's important to note that he is currently at the top of the ladder with a MMR of 56-41, sporting the highest faction MMR in Scoia'tael. I do believe no one is higher than him at 1495. He has dominated the pro ladder. Really, really great players are behind him, and the pro ladder looks good. It doesn't look, there's no outliers. Like, I'm starting to know all these names very well. These are all people that are really active in the community. Most of these people are streamers as well. And I don't know, what do you think about the pro ladder? And like, generally, as the season has gone, like, how have you felt about watching these guys compete for this?
Well, you can see sort of by the number of matches played by these individuals, at over 400 matches per player, of course, just to qualify for full MMR. And then, you know, Adzikov with over 600, Mago with almost 800 points or 800 matches right now. Super JJ has over 700. So these players are playing a lot. And so that means that really we talked about tournaments being a time sink for one day, being 11 hours straight. But the pro ladder is really a time sink in terms of making sure that you get those matches in and then getting your ranking up. And we're seeing that it's really important that you don't just try to push through those first 400 games to unlock your MMR, and that trying to win as many as you can on your way up is really important, or else, you know, you can get your top 400, like we mentioned about Rivolf, who I think has fallen quite far since he was the first to hit his first 400 games. So, I like to see the top players playing varying decks, and a lot of times, you know, you don't necessarily see that. And seeing Life Coach playing different Skellige lists to try to climb up the pro ladder, for example, is pretty cool. And seeing someone like, this is what we wanted, right? We wanted to see specific faction MMRs to see who's the best at what faction, and we figured out that Adzikov is the best at Scoia'tael right now. And I mean, no one's even challenging him for it. It's not even close. There's nobody as close as 1495. I don't see anybody in the top 20 or the top 40 even who are above 1450 or so. So that's how dominant he's been with his faction. And that's sort of what I want to see with pro ladders. I want to see it be a season-long commitment. Show your dominance with certain factions that you're the best at, and then get the crown points and the invites.
Yeah, and so we know that Adzikov is going to make it. He's going to be the final seat at Gwent Slam. Mostly what is known about Adzikov is that he is just a very, very good player, and there's stats to back it up, because here he is at the top of the pro ladder. And I think that that's one of the most interesting directions you can take a wild card player. Like, we don't know much about him. We just know that he is very, very, very good. So he's like, and I've said this around, I think, in Discord as well, it's like he's a warrior from a far off land that has a reputation for conquering, and he's coming in and you're going to maybe play against him. And it's just such great little bits of narrative there. But what I wanted to expand on pro ladder, we're going to see Adzikov play, and that's great. And it's really good that the piece of the pro ladder is a piece to Gwent Slam, but these top like eight players, get used to seeing these names as well. And I think that the fight around, you know, between four and eight, I think that this will change a lot still as we go on. But you're going to see Gwent opens with a lot of these names, and winners of those Gwent opens are going to end up being challengers. And it may not be the top of the ladder, but it's going to be within this top 10 for sure. And I think that all of these names are, you know, it's just, it's right here. It's right here in the numbers. They're very good players. You can see where they're excelling. You can see where they're improving, and you can see their dedication and how many matches they're playing as well.
Yeah, and one such player, really, I think, McBeard, is Tailbot, who's, like you mentioned, the top 4 through 8 are going to be fighting a lot. But in fact, Tailbot has just overtaken Mago to take second in the world right now in the pro ladder. And he also finished very, very well in the second day of the Gwent Slam qualifiers. I think he was top 4, top 8. So this is someone who can definitely compete in tournaments. And right now, sitting at number 2, being the closest player to threaten Adzikoff at the top, he's within 60 points. So, you know, seeing that kind of transpire over the past week and see another player from a far off land sort of just come up and like I said, assert dominance. He has very high MMRs for Squirtle, Northern Realms, Skellige, and Monsters. Just very consistent, and actually a very solid Northern Realms MMR. Might be one of the highest ones I've seen at 1444.
Yeah, it's definitely the highest on the top 20 that we can see by a large margin. There's only like 2 other players that even have 14. Mago being one of them at number 3 here as well. And yeah, it's just, I think that it's great that, you know, it looks like Pro Ladder is doing what it's doing. The people that are playing the best are doing better than people who are playing more but just aren't actually being able to raise that ceiling. But those people who are still playing a lot and playing very well are represented in this top 20. So, you know, you can see like, you can just ascertain which any one of these players are working on. And as time goes on, they are all getting even better than they currently are, because they're forced into figuring out and understanding every possible matchup that could happen in the game, because all factions must be played. So the Pro Ladder has just got a really cool landscape. And I mean, I'm going to find out. I want to talk to a lot of these guys about this kind of when the season is over, especially. But like, how did it feel to be like up there, like really deep and fighting for a place here? And, you know, we're only about halfway through the season, less than that at this point, but there's already so much to talk about.
Yeah, and as a sort of a quick sidebar, I was speaking with one of them earlier today, and because the Pro Ladder doesn't have matchmaking based on MMR, you can match with anybody playing on the Pro Ladder. So a lot of the Pro Ladder right now, McBeard, is just trying to match against someone who might not be as high MMR as you, and being able to sort of take advantage of that sort of, you know, increased experience or play skill that you might have over someone that you normally wouldn't match make with on the ranked ladder.
Yeah, and then you go strolling right into Adzikoff. Like, it could, you know, you could go from like the number 200 person to the number 1 person. And yeah, it's definitely like you might get some wins because somebody's maybe just exploring Pro Ladder for the first time, and you're playing your 500th match.
Yeah,
it's possible, right? That's an actual thing that could happen. So, you know, I like that. I like that volatility. I also kind of like the idea that if I ever wanted to play against some of these people, like it's very possible that I could just hit play and get like a show match for myself.
Ooh.
So, but you know, I would do that on stream for sure. I would give that. I would maybe one day I'll have to do that.
The Pro Ladder is the means to the end. So let's talk about the end here. Let's talk about what everyone's fighting for. Let's talk about Gwent Slam.
Yeah, so Gwent Slam. So these 3 players are joining the 5 already invited players, and those players are Swim, who is one of the originals. He's been around for a very long time, since the very beginning of the closed beta. Participated in some very early tournaments as well. I believe he won the 2nd tournament that was ever held. So, and you know, he's one of the most popular streamers. Not many people don't know who Swim is. He's known for building very innovative decks as well. Melee Man is a streamer from Russia. He's been streaming for a while as well. He's been around since the very beginning as well. Tides of Time, a popular Hearthstone player. He's also a very popular streamer in general, plays a lot of games at a very high competitive level. Has been playing Gwent on and off for the last bunch of months, and I think it'll be really good to see him kind of on the big stage sort of thing. Game King stepping in for Mogwai as the invite from the previous Gwent Together. Game King is a great, great player. He has been at the top of the ladder at some points as well, and we've seen him perform at Gwent Together, and he was really, really good. And of course, Shaggy, the Gwent Open qualifier, going through the wild card and then ultimately winning the first Gwent Open at Gamescom Germany. What do you think about this roster, Gearboxer? There's so many stars here.
This field is a who's who of Gwent, really, at this point in the game. You know, after the closed beta has been out for almost a year now, and I think, you know, there's a number of household names that are coming up. And, you know, we've seen Freddy Babes around for a long time. He's won a number of tournaments. He's a Passiflora champion. We've seen Panda, like we mentioned. We talked about him a lot, being on the ladder, double accounts in the top 10, that kind of thing. And then obviously these guys who've contributed a lot to the community and who are popular from other games too. So, I mean, it's hard almost to pick someone to root for. Like I said, I'm gonna be gunning for Panda here, because I like his like how old school he was, really big into Skellige when I was too. So I think he's probably the closest guy that I'm gonna be rooting for. But all these guys I could get behind, to be honest. So everybody wins with the Gwent Slam, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like some of these players are known for playing specific factions very well. I mean, I've seen Freddy Babes play a very mean Northern Realms. I know Impetuous Panda is like really good at Skellige. And we can ascertain that Adzikoff is very good with most factions, but particularly good with Scoia'tael, based on his faction MMR. But then as we get into the other invitees, like we know that Swim can probably play like a mixed up version of anything and probably be very surprising in some. You know, I think that a lot of people are looking forward to Swim's decks, and you know, seeing Shaggy's deck is going to be great as well, because you know he just came from a tournament in a different like rule set, almost like it was, you know, golds were still immune in that time, and you know all those decks that were very very strong are completely different now. So we're going to get to see if Shaggy was able to adapt and apply that level of expertise to this new meta, and I'm just so pumped because I'm there as well. I will be hosting and casting along with Mogwai and Ash. You may know them from Fate to Karma. You may know them from previous Gwent events, and Ash also from a round of Gwent, CD Projekt Red web show. And of course, they're all streamers as well. So it's really going to be a great event. I think that, you know, this, I don't know if it's a good thing to say that it feels like this is like the golden age right now, but I know that it's, you know, it's on, this game is not, feels like it's been on a permanent upswing, and this event is just a jewel of an event. All these players are so good.
Well, let's step back a little bit. Let's have a little bit of perspective, right? Let's think about how this would have looked a year ago, right? And it's exceeded all of our expectations at every juncture. And now, a year later, you know, you're shoutcasting and hosting an event with some of the most favorite people in Gwent. And you're right, it is probably the golden age right now, because I could see a year from now looking back very fondly on this event when everyone was still very close and in touch, and these giant teams hadn't formed, and these world tours hadn't happened yet, and all these other huge things that are going to happen in the next year, and people are going to get scattered. So I think you should really cherish this time, because you're going to be, you know, together very closely with some people that are really awesome at this game and who are pretty awesome to hang out with too.
There's also something to be said about the amount of time that Gwent has been out. It's been almost a year. October 25th is the Gwent anniversary of the closed beta launch. And I think that there's a sweet spot here where it's been almost a year. A lot of these players, if not all of these players, have had time to, you know, get some wins under their belt, get some, you know, become notorious for something, develop a fan base, achievements generally throughout the game. And, you know, we know who these people are. All of these players have stories to tell. So I think that, you know, just that sort of that full kind of we can look back a year ago and see where we started from. And here we are today, you know, going to Life Coach's house, playing in the first licensed Gwent event, third party licensed Gwent event, and being part of the first kind of road to Gwent Masters, as kind of this whole thing is blossoming. So, you know, it's good. It feels like a great time, and hopefully everybody really enjoys themselves watching this event. I'm sure that if it matches the quality of the Gwent Together, then, you know, that's going to go without saying. But I'm really happy to be a part of it. Hope you all really enjoy it as well. And yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about this awesome event that's coming up?
No, I'm just really excited to watch it, and I hope that everybody else is too.
So, moving on from that, we have another star joining us in the studio right now, the Commander's Horn studio. It is our pleasure to welcome our friend Jagaris. We're going to talk to her about, you know, what she's been up to, where she came from, and a little bit about Scoia'tael as well after this. It is our pleasure to be joined by Gwent community member, host, video producer, Norway's own, Jagras. Jagras, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me. You made me sound so fancy.
You're fancy, aren't you?
You've got a good CV. I mean, really.
Yeah, you've been doing some, you've been making content for Gwent for a while now, and you know, you you work on deck guides. We know you're going through The Witcher as well. The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt. Is that your first playthrough, by the way? Or is this like, is it
I'm
blind?
I'm like one of those weird people who never played Witcher and then played Gwent and then was like, oh, I guess I should play The Witcher. Mm-hmm. I played a little bit when it came out. I think I played up to like the Griffin fight or whatever. But I wasn't really sold. I was playing it on Xbox and the TV was really far away. I couldn't read any of the text half the time. I was like, I'm just like squinting at the screen. And the first kind of hour of the game is quite slow. So I played to that point and then never played it again. And then started playing Gwent. And was like, I should probably actually find out where all these characters come from. And now I have a never-ending Let's Play that I'm like 30 parts into, and the end is nowhere near. So we'll see how it goes.
You can always pick it up, though. That's one of the best parts about a game of that size is if you just want to go through it at your own pace, just kind of pick it up when you can. And there's like hundreds of hours of content in there for you.
Yeah,
and
it's funny that. Pretty...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I was just saying it was good. It's funny. Tell me, what is funny?
Oh, it's funny that there's more or less like two paths to Gwent that a lot of our guests have had. Either they've been really into Gwent from playing it as a mini game, playing it a ton in The Witcher and multiple playthroughs and just like grinding out the single player version of Gwent. And then it's like the standalone's coming out. Of course I'm going to play the beta. But in the other half are, you know, people who have gone into Gwent because of interest in the card game scene or the competitive scene or just creating content for a pretty solid game coming out. And then they discover that, oh my gosh, The Witcher is pretty amazing. So it's cool to see that you're from that camp and that you've been so captured by, you know, both of these really tentpole games from CD Projekt Red.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird way to come from it, especially if I tell you guys I've never played Hearthstone. People are just like, you've never played Hearthstone? You play card games? But I mean, I've played like a tiny amount of Hearthstone. I think I played some bot games at once. Like, I understand how Hearthstone works. You know, I'm not one of these people who's like, has no understanding of anything to do with Hearthstone. I understand the premise of it, but I've definitely played under like 3 hours of Hearthstone in my life. I actually came into card gaming from a game called Chronicle, which was Jagex's attempt at a card game. They were making this actually it was a really cool card game, but they were kind of making it as a side project based off of RuneScape. Which Merchant was the community manager for at the
time.
Yeah, so I knew him from before Gwent, because I used to make Chronicle videos, and I used to do Chronicle deck guides, because it turned out I'm kind of mediocre at most games, but I'm actually kind of good at card games, and I was kind of surprised by this. So then I was making deck guides for that, but Jagex as a company, they had made some like management changes, and they weren't really willing to invest into the game. Basically, they did this kind of one update about a year ago and then just kind of left it to die. So I'd spent all this time kind of building a name for myself in Chronicle and then it kind of died. And that was really depressing. So I kind of stayed away from card games for a bit. And then Merchant was like, oh, I'm playing Gwent. So I was watching his stream and then he was like, you know, oh, DM me. And he actually sent me a beta key and I was like, right, are we going to go down this road again? And I was like, you know what, we'll give it a try. We'll see how it goes. Because originally I didn't have access to closed beta and I just enjoyed watching people play Gwent. I was like, one of those people who never played the game and just watched other people play it. And so I kind of had the basics and then I started making deck guides and I realized there was like no beginner deck guides. So I was like, right, I can kind of understand the basics. I'll make beginner deck guides. And then by the time I'm done making beginner guides, I'll have learned enough to make like intermediate deck guides. And yeah, that's kind of how it all started.
I like that. It's like your POV as like a new player. As you approach the game as a seasoned card game player, but still a new player to Gwent. It also sounds like Twitch kind of taught you how to play Gwent.
Yeah, pretty much. I learned a lot from just watching streams. And I kind of realized that it's a really fun game to watch. I still enjoy watching streams now. Like, you'll see me in various streams. Maybe, you know, I show up in your stream from time to time as well. Like, I really enjoy watching Gwent. Sometimes more so than playing it, because I feel like when you play it, it can be a bit stressful, but when you're watching other people, it's like, you know, if they mess up, it's fine. It's fine. It's not on me. I can just laugh at them a little bit and maybe not make that mistake in the future.
Yeah, I learned what not to do.
That's how I actually got into Gwent, is I was really into playing the single player version. I'm from that first set of people, and I used to play it just late at night, kind of relaxing with a drink, and it was kind of how I'd wind down at the end of the long day. And I find, you know, if I'm not streaming myself late at night now, that I just like to watch other streams, and it's still relaxing, but you're still so invested. And, you know, especially depending on the streamer, there's a lot of good ones at late night, but it's really sort of relaxing to be in the game but not have it be on your account. You know what I mean?
Oh, I totally agree with you. I think like streams are a good way to kind of unwind from Gwent whilst also still being involved in Gwent. And then I kind of realized that most of my time is spent like with involved in Gwent in some way, and I'm kind of like, maybe I should get, you know, like a hobby or something.
It is your hobby.
Because Greyboxer, you never played Hearthstone either, so it's not even like I'm the odd person out in the room here in that I actually have like a little bit of Hearthstone experience, whereas neither of you, it seemed like you started with Hearthstone. You had different ways in, so it's just interesting that the way Jagger, as he presented it, like it was weird that you hadn't played Hearthstone, but Greyboxer himself as well.
You see, he's got impeccable taste.
I'll tell you a quick short story about Hearthstone. Is I, as I mentioned, became obsessed with Gwent from the Witcher version of it, and I was so voracious for a card game, I was doing the Googling of what's the best digital card game, and literally I don't know how many ads that Blizzard paid to have Hearthstone be at the top of those search lists, but it was always Hearthstone. So I downloaded it on my phone because I realized it was mobile. And I played through it. I mean, it was good. It was just so shallow that I wasn't really able to really put a lot of strategy behind it. And it just felt like I was just losing silly games that I didn't care about because of random chance. So I actually sort of happened into the Gwent beta just by Googling around card games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that SEM, that's a real monster, that search engine marketing. What is a good card game? And then the money talks, for sure.
I mean, Blizzard does have more money than sense, so if you're gonna do it, you may as well do it right.
You got to invest a little bit.
I always say more dollars than cents. Sometimes, you know what I'm talking about.
Terrible pun.
So that's cool. You kind of gave us. We were going to ask you about your path to Gwent. So you kind of covered that, just kind of sort of in this little opening discussion. But one thing that we do like to ask is, what games did you grow up playing? Like, what games kind of defined your sort of gaming personality of today?
I'm trying to think like where to start. So it all started, I guess, when I was like a kid, and we decided to save up, me and my siblings, I have two brothers and two sisters, for a console. And like, we were all saving our money and we were going to get an N64. We had a Sega Mega Drive, so I played like some Sonic and stuff, but I was like kind of maybe a bit too young for that kind of generation. So we're like, we'll get a N64. And then we've been saving for ages. And then it turned out the PlayStation 1 was slightly cheaper than the N64. So we were like, you know what, stuff it. Don't need an N64, we'll get a PlayStation instead. So we got a PlayStation, and I grew up playing a lot of kind of PlayStation games with my brothers, mostly. We played a lot of like Crash Team Racing, for example. I played through Crash Bandicoot when I was smaller. Lots of just kind of multiplayer PlayStation-based games, not so much single-player stuff. And that was kind of how I was when I was younger, and then as I got older, I kind of moved on to PC gaming, and I played a lot of World of Warcraft and RuneScape and kind of MMOs. I was kind of into that in my teenage years. And then I bought an Xbox because I got a job. And my boyfriend at the time had an Xbox 360. So then I was like, wait, I want to play Xbox with my boyfriend. I'll buy an Xbox. And played a hell of a lot of Halo. And oh my god, like Halo 3 was just, it holds such a dear spot place in my heart, is Halo 3. So then I was like a console player for a bit until I went to uni, and then saved up some money and got a decent desktop, and here I am, however many years later, playing all sorts. But yeah, it was kind of just like a social thing a lot for me. Like, I still don't play a lot of single player. Like with The Witcher, the fact that I'm doing a Let's Play is probably the reason I'm like as far into it as I am, just because I feel like I have a short attention span for single player games, whereas multiplayer games often are like, they're kind of quite, you know, short. Like a game of Gwent is what, like 10 to 20 minutes long, and then you can stop and you can come back and play another 10 to 20 minute game, and it's different every time, but there's not necessarily all that, you don't need to pay attention to everything that's come before to know where you are now. So for me, multiplayer games have always been kind of a gateway for me into gaming, and it's been good.
And so you've been covering Gwent for like a while now, and you've been to a number of gaming conventions, and have you been to anything recently that you like to share your stories about, or anybody you've met, or what have you been up to lately in terms of being a, you know, sort of a traveling gaming journalist?
I haven't been to a lot of events in, like, very recently. I went to, actually, well, I went to Insomnia 61 in the UK back in, like, then August. That's kind of like a small convention, but it's mostly at a LAM. And that's more kind of a social thing. That was for me just hanging out with a bunch of friends who I play video games with online, and then we meet up and play video games for 4 days. But it was actually really funny because it turned out the guy who was sitting behind me in the LAN hall was streaming. And then, so I kind of realized he was streaming, and I was like, right, it's now my, like, mission to find his stream. And so I found his stream, and I was like, guys, if you want to see me at LAN, like, just go on this guy's stream. You can see the back of my head. But it was such a shame because he was like, he had like two viewers or something. And then a few people showed up and were like, you know, show us the girl behind you.
It's so awkward for him.
Yeah, he doesn't know
what's going on.
It was meant to be playing Counter-Strike, but he kind of just sat there and didn't play Counter-Strike for a bit. And then he's like, who's Jaggerus? And then he followed me on, like, Twitter. And I was like, no, this is not like the end game that I had in mind for this event. In the end, like, he kind of figured out that I was the person behind him, but it was quite hilarious. But in terms of events, because, like, I used to be really involved in Smite, which is a MOBA. Yeah. And so I've been to their, like, world championships twice. For, like, the esports scene. So esports events are, like, one of my favorite things to go to. They're always really, really good. And I can't really wait for Gwent events because you basically end up at a venue full of people who love the same game that you do and are passionate about the same game as you. And you end up with, like, you know, hundreds or thousands of people all roaring and cheering for people playing video games. And it's honestly, like, some of the most fun events I've been to, I would say, are esports events rather than necessarily conventions. Just because of the atmosphere and everyone being passionate about the same game. And, you know, you always meet really, really cool people. And it's also a great way to find merch, like merchandise, not merchant, for games that you like. And I need some more Gwent merch. So I guess you could probably find merch at a Gwent event. That's kind of likely as well. But yeah, I need some new Witcher merch and some Gwent merch. So I think CDPR needs to have an event.
I think it's, yeah, well, you said it right when you said that being at an event where you play the game and, like, you go to a Gwent event and everybody kind of, like, you go to an esports event and you know that you're among like-minded people. Like, you at least know that you could basically turn to anybody and talk to them about the game and they'll have, like, an interesting opinion on it, as opposed to, like, maybe most social events that we go to. The entire room of people maybe can't really talk to you about Gwent. But I can tell you that the competitive scene for Gwent, it is nice. It is very comfortable to be in a room full of, like, Gwent people. And I think that scene is taking off. And you've been involved a little bit with the TGI. You've done some hosting and casting. How have you been enjoying being part of that Gwent competitive scene? How have you enjoyed watching the competitive scene evolve so far?
Oh, it's really fun. It's something I always kind of wanted to do. And I think it's really difficult to get your kind of foot in the door with these sorts of things, especially because Gwent doesn't have spectator and it doesn't have replays. So this kind of organizing tournaments to be broadcast independently of CDPR is really difficult because you have to effectively convince anyone who's playing to record their games and send them to you so, like, you can cast them. And I think Gwentlemen have done a really good job with the TGI. It's been, you know, a lot of kind of admin work. And they basically messaged me being like, would you like to come host on one of our days, basically just kind of you intro it, a little bit of analysis, that sort of thing. And I was like, this is perfect. This is, like, definitely something I really want to be involved in. So I kind of jumped at the chance. And then I was, like, the most nervous I think I've ever been, because when I stream or YouTube or whatever, like, you kind of have, that's my own community and that's my own audience and they kind of know what to expect. But then when you're putting yourself out there in front of, like, a few hundred viewers who've maybe never encountered you before, you know, Twitch chat can be very fickle and they can be quite, like, unkind. So I was ooh, just, like, the most nervous. And I was like, just please don't be terrible. But it went really well. And they were really, like, decent. And then TGI, they asked me, Gwentlemen, to be the host, like, for the next week and then the next week. And then they're like, we just want you to be a regular host. So that was really cool. Except that they've given me a new co-host every single week. So every week it's like I'm with someone brand new and we have to kind of figure out our synergy and go from there. So it's definitely tough. But in terms of the esports side of things, it's really cool to see the games and it's really cool to see kind of the players and how they think and the kind of different strategies that teams are employing, especially with TGI, because as I'm sure you guys know, having been involved in it, it's like a 3v3. So it's very different from, you know, your 1v1 Gwent that we see at CD Projekt Red tournaments. Like, the people who are playing have other people talking to them at the same time and they're discussing tactics and stuff. So it's kind of interesting to see, you know, how that turns out. And then when there is a misplay, you know that three people kind of messed up, so it's extra bad.
Yeah, co-op is kind of weird. Sometimes when you get really used to, because, you know, the Commander's Horn Commandos, we talked about it earlier, Commander's Horn Commandos did get eliminated in the beginning of the playoffs, unfortunately. But, you know, when you do a co-op with other people, it's you are deferring to their what they think is a good decision. And sometimes that can kind of pollute the natural decision-making process you might go through by yourself. So your combined minds aren't necessarily like the sum of its parts. It's like a new beast altogether. So it's like, it's been a really interesting experience being part of the team league. We're talking about the Gwentlemen's Invitational Team League, which is currently at the time of this recording going into its top 8, I believe. It's been a really cool event, and yeah, you've been a part of that, and that's cool to hear your experiences with that.
Yeah, it's top 8, yeah. And that'll be, I'm going to just shamelessly promote it, broadcast on Tuesday, and then finals are on Thursday. So if you want to find out what happens, that's where you should be.
That's where you should be.
Yeah, well, I've been there for a couple of the shoutcasts, and they're quite good. And you're right, saying that you know Twitch can be sort of mean sometimes is incredibly true. It might be a masterpiece of understatement, but to say that they were decent was a huge compliment to Twitch chat, and they were actually very positively inclined towards you. And sometimes they made fun of the other hosts. But anyway, it was still really fun to watch, and you did quite well. Did you start your first one with HG3?
Yep, that was my first week. That was
That was when you started.
He's really fun to work with. He clearly knows his stuff. So I think like for a first week, that was a really good one because he obviously is quite comfortable. So then, as a new person, it made me quite comfortable. Whereas the following week was Ocean Mud, and he was new. So then I was the person who was like the veteran. And then I worked with Lamios, and again he was new to hosting. He'd done some casting, but then I was again the veteran. So it's nice to have someone who's done it before when you first start with things like hosting or analysis, or I guess casting would be similar.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, HG3, friend of the show. I remember that. That was actually a good, that was the one where we were the showcase match, the Commanders on Commandos, the unfortunate video error cast where I had the shaky video and we all had a good laugh about how the video was shaky. But that was also the match with that weird like mill armor matchup that I was, when we finished the match, we thought, man, that was a good game. So yeah, I remember that. That was a good cast. So I have one thing I wanted to talk to you about before we get into talking about Squaytel strategy with you. I just wanted to address, there was a tweet that you sent out to Commander's Horn many weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? It's who you sent out. You said you had a dream of coming onto the podcast and talking about dogs for 2 hours. So we want to make part of this. We want to make part of this dream come true. We can't give you 2 hours, but just tell me, do you have dogs and are they good dogs?
Oh, God. All dogs are good dogs. What kind of question is that?
That was a trick question.
That is a trick question. You're never going to be like, you're a bad dog. Like, dogs can misbehave, but they're still good dogs, you know, even if they, like, knocked over the bin or, like, destroyed something or, like, pooped on the floor. They're still a good dog. They didn't do it to hurt you, you know? Yeah, it was a weird dream. I was like, oh, okay, this is a Gwent podcast. And then you're like, right, and we're going to talk about dogs. And I was like, that's fine. I can name lots of kinds of dogs. I can, you know, I can talk about dogs for a good long time. I don't actually have any of myself. My mom has 4 that, if you follow me on Twitter, will regularly show up whenever I'm there because they're good dogs, you know. And I'd love to have a dog, but I just don't live somewhere that allows it at the moment. And I guess that was my dream. I got to live vicariously through talking about them.
Well, it would be a natural segue from talking about Wild Hunt hounds, probably.
I also love dogs, but do not have a dog. My in-laws have a wonderful dog, but also live in a place where having a dog doesn't quite work, and it wouldn't be, we're gone too long during the day. I don't know about you, but you know, I'd like to have a dog and have it with me all the time, like a best buddy, you know, like a golden retriever, kind of like with a bandana. Like, that's my dream. It's my dream.
I hope your dream comes true. My dream has just come true, so you know.
Exactly. That's what we wanted. All right. So, Jagras, we talked to you. We wanted you to come on, and we wanted to do, we're doing a, what we call a five faction tour right now. And it's really good, kind of in the new patch. There is a new influx of cards, so we feel like we can naturally cover that. Talking about Scoia'tael with you, Jagras, as that was your, that was one of your picks to talk about. So let's hop to our strategy section, and we'll talk about these new Scoia'tael cards and where Scoia'tael is in the meta right now.
Maybe not today and not tomorrow, but someday, someone will find a way to take you down.
So Scoia'tael right now, I think that Scoia'tael is in a really great place. I feel like all the leaders are represented in fairly competitive decks, and within each of those leaders having competitive decks out there, there's still variations between each of these archetypes, or possibly even more than one, and kind of hybrids between them. I think that the deck, the faction is probably, I mean, even after a very intense hotfix where we saw Scoia'tael go through a lot of changes, nerfs in some cases, I feel like the faction is in a fairly good spot. Jagras, do you feel like, do you agree with that statement, or do you feel like that it's you know, there's some issues at the moment?
See, I feel like Scoia'tael is in the spot that, like, all of the factions should be. So I feel like Scoia'tael is in a good spot, but Northern Realms and Monsters are a little overtuned so that they are overshadowing Scoia'tael. Like, I feel like with Scoia'tael's cards and the kind of power that they can put out and the kind of synergies that they have, they're all fairly nice. They don't feel so insane as, say, some of the Northern Realm strategies with things like, you know, Stennis and Shani and Natalis and that. They don't have these kind of crazy overtuned plays. So I feel like in terms of balancing, Scoia'tael is what CDPR should kind of aspire to. But then in terms of comparing them to other factions, I would say the Northern Realms and Monsters are much stronger.
Hmm. I feel like Nilfgaard is also very strong right now as well. I feel like Skellige, I feel like, might actually be in the worst spot, but yeah. I feel like maybe that's just a perception thing, and it's also just kind of like a meta thing. Like, I don't necessarily think that Skellige has terrible, like, decks or anything. I know Greatsword's very strong, but I think that, yeah, Scoia'tael might actually be, if I had to rank them, maybe fourth place, but I still think that, I agree with you, it's, from a balance standpoint, this is maybe where we want to be with the faction. Greyboxer, you've been playing a little bit of Scoia'tael as well?
Yeah, I've been playing, you know, a variation of the a very popular movement archetype, and it's been going well. It's a really fun deck to play, and it feels, it's one of the most interactive decks to play, and as such, it's very visceral feeling, and you can feel yourself making an effect on the game board all the time, because every play, you're moving cards around, you're moving your opponents around, and, you know, I don't play a lot of Aridin, but I assume that this is sort of how Aridin feels with Frost and using Drowners and moving them around and Karanthyr and that kind of thing. But I prefer buffing and dwarves as my strategies. So I've seen a lot of these new cards that have come out have really enabled the movement archetype, which is something that was sort of almost a meme last patch, I think. So to have them basically put in a couple of bronze cards that have enabled an entire archetype and then watch it rocket to maybe tier two in the meta right now, but a very close second. Like, I think it's very close to those top Nilfgaard, Monster, and R decks. It's just almost there. But for me, it's a lot of fun to play. So I like a lot of the ways the new cards are working with the old ones that we liked quite a lot, like Zoltan and so on. So yeah, I think that you're right, Jagras. I think that it's in the spot that we want the other factions to be in. And it feels like there's no crazy, like you mentioned, John Natalis, there's no overpowered, like, dump all your strength into one card kind of plays with this. Maybe, I mean, you could say Sheldon Skaggs, but that's so greedy that the amount of points that he's going to get isn't even as big as Natalis most of the time. So, yeah, I think it's in a great spot, and I'm excited to talk about these new cards.
Yeah, let's talk about the new cards. I mean, I think Movement Scoia'tael is, like, legit, like, quite strong, actually. Like, I need to maybe experiment with it, but it's a deck that's really hard to contest in a really long round, and just what it can actually get going if you can't really stop their marksman, and, you know, if they get weather being played on you, and they're just bouncing you all over the place, and lining you up for hailstorms, pinging you like crazy with the marksman. I mean, we're going to talk about the new cards, but there are a lot of, kind of changed and more potent changed bronzes in those decks than there are of the new cards. But movement. Yeah, I want to talk about movement a little bit more on the back end of this, but let's talk about some of the new cards. Let's talk about the spell cards first, I think. Let's talk about Sage first. So Sage is a 3-strength agile unit that resurrects a special card from your graveyard and then banishes it once you replay it. So it allows you to play, if you have played a Thunder at some point in the game, you can play it again with Sage. This card was one of the cards that got nerfed in that it banishes the spell that it resurrects, so you can't chain Sages together, which I think is great because that was a little oppressive, I think, from a control standpoint. And it was doing some pretty nasty stuff with the old Stammelford's Tremors. But nowadays, it feels like just another way to reactivate spells, boost Dolblethana Protectors in spell decks, and you know, it's got a fair amount of power to it, but you don't have to play Sages in spell decks. What do you think about Sage, Jagras? Have you been using it in any of your Scoia'tael decks?
I don't have Sage. I milled them all when they were worth full value and have not felt the need to craft them since. I think I like Sage as a premise with the resurrecting a bronze alchemy or spell, but because you then banish it, it means that you have to play all of your spells or alchemy cards that you intend to resurrect before you start playing your Sages. Like, if I have a hand and I happen to have a Sage, but I've already played one and I have no spells or alchemy cards in my graveyard, it's effectively 3 points. And I think that can be very limiting, especially depending on how you draw. And with Scoia'tael, you can thin to a certain extent, but because you can't necessarily guarantee getting those alchemy cards or spells in your hand, I think since they nerfed it, where there's now the banish effect, you know, it's seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of play that it has. So I guess I feel like it's an interesting card, but unless you have a very safe way of finding spells, or you're running a deck that's more or less consistently like a lot of spells, it's difficult to find a place for it in many decks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it does fit in the spell archetype the best, and it does enable, as McBeard said, the protectors, but it is weakened by the randomness of pulling out your spell cards with mercenaries, which only give you 2 choices out of all the other bronze cards in your deck, so you might not want to put those cards in your graveyard because you didn't want to use them that early. And I know a lot of people have accidentally pulled Alzir's Thunder with an opening merc, and that kind of thing happens, and you know, then you've got a good card in the graveyard for your Sage at least. But I think that Sage for me is, last patch was probably one of the best bronzes in the game, and the reason for that is resurrection at all in Gwent is very powerful. And we saw, you know, ages ago when Northern Realms had bronze medics and could get their units back out, that was very powerful. And Sages do the same thing, but Scoia'tael style with the spells. And so the fact that you can choose any spell, that's even better than the old field medics used to be in Northern Realms. And so when I look at Sage, I think that it's just such a good, solid bronze card for spell Scoia'tael. Yeah, I think that the change in the hotfix, what was it, almost 2 weeks ago now, was perfect to make it banish. But because it does limit your flexibility in how you use it, and it makes it much more tactical. So really good card and perfect for spell Scoia'tael.
Yeah, I mean the card feels very strong if you're playing a deck that can be controlled. Like if you're playing something that depends on maybe like Greatsword ships or maybe Mangonels, warships, stuff like that, where the Thunder train can start and it won't stop because your Merc gets the Thunder out. Now you have your Sage to pull the Thunder out, or even Ithleen. If you Ithleen Thunder and then you have 2 Sages in your hand, you're getting 4 Thunders and only 1 Thunder was actually used out of your deck. It's like an Axeman. I think Skellig actually suffers in a control archetype. Like I've seen Axeman just shut down by Sages and Thunders. So it's like the one situation where I think control actually has, you can get a real stranglehold on round one if you can get the Thunder train going with Sages. But I feel like, I mean, if I had to rank this between like strong card, fine card, or needs love, I think I'd put it at fine. I think it has its use. I think it can be strong in the right circumstances, but I also don't think that it's auto-include by any
definitely
stretch
of the
imagination.
It kind of went from being ridiculous, so then in comparison to where it was before the hotfix, it kind of feels lackluster, but that's just because where it was before the hotfix was crazy.
Yeah. So let's talk about another card that synergizes with spell decks, but not just with spell decks, really any deck that's running boosting in general. And Scoia'tael, I believe, don't quote me on this, but I do believe that they're the faction with the most cards that actually boost. So many of their cards actually have boosting effects. So the Farseer can synergize with so many things, but we're seeing it in spell, since every spell you cast will boost a protector that might be in your hand, which means the Farseer will activate every single turn and snowball out of control in some situations. So Farseer is seeing play in spell decks these days. What have your experiences been with Farseer, Jagras?
I think she's in a really good place with the Farseer, because she's obviously, if a different ally or unit in your hand is boosted, she boosts herself by 2 at the end of a turn, but that's only... like, that's once, regardless of how many boosts you do. So if you played Ithilien, for example, and did a double boost on your spell... what are they called? The ones that get boosted if you play a spell.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you got a double boost on those. The Farseer will only boost once. So it's not ridiculously out of control. Or if you played a load of Rehead Brigades and then they were buffing multiple units in your hand, the Farseer, still, she only gets the one boost per turn. So I feel like... in terms of a balanced card, you were talking about, you know, overtuned, undertuned, or just right. She's just right, and I like her in spell decks, and I also like her in hand boosting decks, although they're not very meta at the moment. Decks which run, say, Freehead Brigades, decks which run, say, Francesca, look into things like, you know, Teruvial and Brayen and boosting them in order for a round 3 win condition. I think she fits quite nicely into those kind of decks as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing some Farseer is being used in spell decks as well because of the protectors getting buffed. Obviously, like, it depends on whether or not you drew any protectors, but hopefully you did. And they're going to be getting buffed all the time. It's very consistent to be able to put a Farseer down and watch it grow. So they can get out of hand too.
Yeah, it adds tempo to every spell you cast in a spell deck and really kind of demands attention. I don't think that it's too strong, but I definitely think it's on the upper side of okay. Again, if we're just kind of looking at those three outcomes, I guess, for each of these. Farseer and Sage, yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say, if you find yourself in a matchup against a spell deck or if you see Ethna, just be aware of Farseers and spell decks. If you end up finding yourself up against one, it's probably the best lock target out there, so get your locks early on the Farseer.
Yeah, I play a lot of Radovid, and I find that being able to apply locks to units like this, and also like the card that we're about to talk about, the Mahaka Marauder, I think that being able to kind of suppress your opponent's snowball effects, cards like Farseer and Mahaka Marauder kind of really do demand a solution, because it's just rollover value every turn. And lots of factions have cards like that, and they work in a different way. But the cool thing about Farseer is that the way it boosts itself isn't dependent on actually running a spell deck with protectors. You could also run a mulligan deck with the officers, which boost every turn, and the mulliganing of the Vread Brigade or Vanguards that boost every turn. So, you know, there's lots of situations where Farseer can work. So it's like, it feels like, and we kind of talked about this when it was revealed, you know, it's a card, it's kind of like a card for the faction. It's like generally going to be good and always maybe an option. So, but not an auto include. So I think it's actually in a really, really good spot. But Mahaka Marauder, let's talk about the dwarves that were added. So three rest of the cards are all dwarf related. The dwarven package, Grey Boxer's getting excited about it, I'm sure. Mahaka Marauder, though, is a really resilient card, an 8 strength card that gets boosted when it is damaged, weakened, strengthened, or boosted itself. At any time, it boosts itself back up. So it works. It has, just like the Farseer, a lot of different synergies, whether you're damaging your own board with Stamelford's Tremors, you're boosting your entire board with Full Moon and getting that extra little bit because you're boosting that, or you're boosting it just manually with something like Hawker Healer. So there's a lot of ways you can use it. We've been seeing it used with Full Moon potions, I think, most popularly. But Jagras, how do you feel about the Mahaka Marauder?
I play a lot of movement square tell with gold weather, so every time I see them, I'm like, really? Really? You're going to do this to me? Like, I think the Marauder's actually not too bad in terms of where it is. I think it's one of those cards you have to keep an eye on, because as you change other cards that maybe boost or damage, it's one of these cards that could be ridiculous. Because unlike Farseer, which only boosts once regardless of how many times you trigger the effect, this one, it boosts every single time anything happens. So if you damage the unit 3 times in one turn, it gets boosted 3 times in one turn. You know, if it then gets hit by weather, that counts as a boost as well. It's not once per turn, it's every single turn. And it's great, like I said, against weather, because every time it gets hit by weather, it boosts by 2. So it effectively negates weather. So it's nice against all these gold weather cards we're seeing currently in the meta. And I think it's in an okay place, because I think the options that you have for boosting or damaging are fairly well balanced. But it's definitely a card that, as a weather, gold weather player, every time I see it, I'm like, go on. Can you not just play something different? You know, it's a little bit frustrating, I would say.
You're tired of seeing these guys when you're just trying to play your gold weathers, right? And everybody who's playing them is playing them because they're tired of seeing gold weathers, all right? And yeah. I think that you make a good point that with a meta that's, you know, filled with gold weathers, and if you're playing them yourself, I'm playing them. I'm playing a ton of them. I'm even playing Skelligastorm. And with that situation where these guys are often going to be tanking the weather effectively and then, you know, boosting even and counteracting it, they're a huge counter meta play. And I really like Mahaka Marauders. And that's sort of what they're perfect for. They're right now, with gold weather being so huge, they are the perfect play.
I think that I like the idea. I read a deck guide. I can't remember what the deck guide was, but they referred to the Ragnarok and Drought combo as the quote scumbag package. you add it to your deck if you just really want to be super oppressive and just apply like massive pressure in a round. So the fact that there are cards that, I mean, not all factions have access to them. I know that like Redanian Knights is a great example for Northern Realms, and a card that kind of combats weather, kind of echoing back to the immune to weather units of old that ultimately have been made more interesting with very, very resilient cards like the Marauder. But I also think the Marauder benefits from a card, since it is a snowball unit and it does gain power over time, it benefits from the next card that I'd like to talk about, which is the Dwarven Agitator. The Dwarven Agitator being a 2-strength card, an agile card that pulls a random bronze dwarf. It doesn't pull it, sorry. It spawns a copy of it.
Yeah.
This is important. So it's not actually pulling it out of the deck, it's spawning a copy of it. So you can tailor the Dwarven Agitator to pull a very specific dwarf, or you can just kind of run like a, you know, just a grab bag of dwarves if you just wanted to maybe make it a bit more of a fun, interesting deck. But being able to tailor it to having stuff like Mahaka Marauders come out, it forces your opponent to have more than just kind of three answers to your three Marauders. You could end up having maybe five or six of these Marauders. So it makes them a little bit more potent, kind of in, not in a vacuum, but also in the same atmosphere of the Agitator. And the Agitator can kind of be that, oh, you have three answers, or you have like a number of answers for my cards. Well, I'm going to be able to create five or six of them. I think the Agitator is a really cool card, especially when you control the RNG aspect of it, but it's also a super fun card as well. Jaggers, have you played with the Dwarven Agitator at all?
Oh, I use them all the time in movement to recreate like extra Dwarven mercs so that I can move units around. I think it's kind of interesting. People complain about RNG and randomness, but because you can kind of control it by only running one kind of bronze dwarf, it's a very interesting card to give you those extra options, and it also kind of just tacks 2 points onto whatever it is that you're spawning. The downside being, if you happen to draw all of your Dwarven Mercs or Dwarven Marauders, then it's 2 points. So if you're up against something like Mill, it can be it's a card that you need to make sure that you're playing before they mill out your dwarves that you want to copy. I haven't actually ever played it in a kind of random sense. I've played against it in a random sense, and for me, I feel like it's just a bit too risky. You know, like having a card where you're not 100% sure what it's going to do, in a lot of situations that's okay because there's very few specific options that you've kind of planned for. But if you're running kind of a Dwarven grab bag, you know, you maybe want to get a Marauder and you end up with a Merc, or you end up with just any other kind of Dwarf, a Skirmisher, for example. Like you could maybe want to deal damage and you end up with Resilience, or you could want to like have a Marauder and you end up with a Mercenary. I feel like it's too risky for Gwent, because at the moment a lot of decks are very consistent, so taking that chance can be dangerous.
Yeah, I think that this card has enabled the movement archetype almost single-handedly, for the reason that a lot of times your very important Dwarven Mercenaries could whiff if you top deck them round three. They could whiff if you just didn't have a unit on the board, or especially before the gold immunity patch, you couldn't move a golden unit. So I played a lot of dwarves before and after the gold immunity patch, and I like them. I mean, I liked Mercenaries now better than ever, and Agitators give them something to move every single time, and therefore get something to buff. So it actually improves your chances of getting the best value out of what is probably your highest value dwarf, your Dwarven Mercenary. Unless you're playing the Marauders again, which steal your opponent's gold weather win conditions, which are also kind of cheeky.
Yeah, I like the Agitators because I think that the cool design space for the Agitators, like we've seen throughout the history of Gwent, there's been problems with cards that clone other cards. And I think that the Agitator is not only, like, it's definitely not outside of the okay spectrum. I think that because there's so many cool applications, and it ultimately is copy a card from your deck and add two kind of thing. Like, I feel like it's not walking the line of it being abusable. In fact, it's only when you are trying to tailor its randomness, and the fact that it has randomness attached to it makes it so you actually have to build a deck tightly around it. And that's where the risk and reward is the riskiest and it's most rewarding, I think. So I think that, you know, because you have to build your deck to specifically cater to the Agitator, you'll never be able to really have it be this flexible nightmare card in where it could maybe imagine if it could pull any bronze card you chose. That would be too strong, I believe. So I think that where it is with the random nature is exactly what's keeping it in check, but also keeping it a fun card and, you know, a very strategic card in that it's creating more opportunities for you to flex with your archetype, like movement or with the Marauders in some situations. Or if you're playing one of these kind of hybrid, you know, control-based, tempo-based decks with the Mahakam Pyrotechnician, which is the last card that I'd like to talk about. The Mahakam Pyrotechnician is an incredibly strong tempo card, especially when you apply some movement effects with Dwarven Skirmishers, or if you didn't want to dilute your Dwarf pool for the Agitator, the Vryad Brigade, which is the Weather Clear unit that also moves units around. So being able to set up board for the Pyrotechnician, which is a 5-strength agile unit that will bomb every row on your opponent's side for 3, if that opportunity exists, making it a 14-point bronze on the best of days. Really great tempo, and it's really strong. You play with the Agitator, it's another 2 points on top of that. You got your 16-point bronzes in Scoia'tael still hanging around. The Mahakam Pyrotechnician is also a really fun card. It feels strong. It also has that sort of risky nature where if you can't create a board for it, it potentially loses value. But I think it's still pretty good. Jagras, have you been playing with the Mahakam Pyrotechnician at all?
I've played around with them. I think they're in a really good spot because, like you say, they can be a really big power play, you know, with those 9 extra points on top of the 5 giving you 14. But on top of that, it could just be a 5. Or generally, I would say, you know, there'll be at least one unit on one row. So, you know, often an 8 to an 11. And I think because of the situational nature of the power, they feel quite well balanced compared to some of the other bronze cards we've seen in this patch and some of the other bronze creep that we've seen in this patch. They have their kind of own little niche, and they fit, like you say, nicely with the movement archetype in that you can kind of move units to different rows, which also synergizes with Gold Weather, and then use them as a kind of control aspect. I don't think they're maybe as popular as some of the other newer cards that we've spoken about, but I do think this is like how we come back to saying that like Scoia'tael's in an okay place. Like all of these cards, they feel really nicely placed within the faction, and I feel like Pyrotechnician is another example of a card that's very well designed.
And you're right that sometimes it's going to really just get you 8 or 11 value, or sometimes, you know, 5 being its lowest point, but it does have the potential of hitting 14. And when it does, you know, that's, you know, people are stacking, they're not stacking rows anymore because of the existence of Marigold's Hailstorm and its power. So in a meta where Marigolds exist, there are usually 2 rows stacked up with a few units to choose from. Not that the Mahakam Pyrotechnician cares. He's just throwing a bomb over the, wall over there and just letting somebody get blown up. But, usually I think you should see 8 to 11 out of this and 14 in a deep round. I mean, that's a great bronze card. I mean, what more can we ask for than to have 14 upside and maybe control something that you want to kill randomly?
Yeah, and we're talking about maybe sometimes when we review cards and talk about cards, I know that lots of people talk about it being, quote, in a vacuum, where in the card as it exists as a card in a very general state, where is its power level? But because you can play this with movement effects, in fact, there's many movement effects in that there's the Dwarven Skirmishers and the Vryad Brigade, being able to set up the board to take advantage of the all 3 rows part of it is realistic. And because Marigold's Hailstorm exists, there's more of an incentive for people to spread the rows out. However, because Gold Weathers exist, there's actually less of an incentive to spread the rows out. So there's a lot of kind of predictive and like, I don't like, sometimes when I play, I don't like feeling like that I'm forced to place units in a specific spot. And I also don't like if like the idea that, well, if my opponent has Pyros, then I don't want to do this. But if he has Hailstorm, then I do want to do this. But if he has Gold Weathers, I don't want to do this. So, and it's really cool that Scoia'tael can kind of exist in this vertical horizontal kind of pincer attack that it can do. Because, you know, last patch we saw a great card in the Dolblethana Trapper. And that was kind of a horizontal card. It was a card that devastated a row, much like how Lacerate and Hailstorm currently do. So they have their horizontal covered with the Trapper, and they have the vertical covered with the Pyrotechnician. And until you're like 100% sure what you're playing against, it's really hard to kind of make that full-on commitment to how you want to structure yourself against Scoia'tael. So, you know, I think overall, movement takes advantage of these guys a lot, and it kind of influences the way your opponent plays once they start seeing them. So,
for sure. That also means a good card to hold, because objectively, that unless you have something that you really need to clear with the three damage, you can kind of sit on them until your opponent has played out a few cards on each row, at which point you can then start slamming down your Pyrotechnicians, you know, at which point they didn't know that you had them, so they haven't prepared for it. And, you know, most units are bigger than, you know, 3, 4, 5 points. You got a lot of 6+ units, so very often it's very easy to play a couple of them in a round and see those 14 points, like, multiple times.
Now, I think that, so we can talk kind of in a more general state about the faction. So I know that we've been talking a lot about movement, and I know that the Mahakam Pyrotechnicians and the Agitators, they play some, well, the Agitators play a part in a couple of other decks as well, but movement-based decks right now are very strong, not just because of the Agitator and the Pyrotechnician, also because of the Dolblethana Marksman and the Dwarven Skirmishers, for instance. So actually, one of the most recent videos that you have up, Jagras, is all about movement, Scoia'tael. So you've been playing that a lot lately. I feel like this deck is actually quite strong, and I do believe that the top of the pro ladder right now, Adzikoff, has been playing some movement, Scoia'tael, as well, for his incredible, very, very close to 1500 faction MMR. So I think movement Scoia'tael is actually in a pretty solid competitive spot. How do you feel about movement Scoia'tael, and do you think that we might see this in tournaments in the future?
I know Impetuous Panda was playing it when he qualified for Gwent Slam this weekend in that very, very long qualifier match that they had. Basically, I think it was like 512 players down to like one finalist that gets to go to Gwent Slam. I know he was using it, and I think it is a fairly solid archetype. It's quite consistent, which is really fun. And I think my favorite thing about it is playing Sheldon Skaggs, the Marigold's Hailstorm Chicken, which is like, that is my favorite thing to do. So obviously Marigold's Hailstorm is your half the row effect, whereas Sheldon, he moves every unit on a row to a different row. So you have to Sheldon before they Marigolds. So often people will Marigolds last, but if they realize or they think that you're going to Sheldon, they'll Marigolds first. So you have this kind of cat and mouse game of you stacking your own row and being like, please don't Marigolds me, please don't Marigolds me, whilst holding on to your Sheldon. And I think it's a really fun archetype to play, but I also think it is actually pretty consistent and pretty strong. There are ways that you can counter it. For example, bleeding round one. Often when you play Gold Weather, you play Gold Weather because you want your opponent to just pass and give you an easy round, which is what basically is movement you want. So if your opponent plays into the weather and can kind of get over the attrition points that you're getting from the weather, then you don't have any very big tempo plays other than Blue Stripe Commandos into Zoltan. So that's a good way to beat them. I feel like it's a beatable deck, but it's also a very consistent deck. And in terms of which Scoia'tael deck people will bring to tournaments, I do expect to see some movement.
Yeah, I think that it's a very viable tournament deck, except that you sort of know what it's going to do, and you almost know the deck list by heart because either you've played it a lot or you've played against it a lot because it's so popular. I know Adzikoff is running like a fairly standard version of the deck with Dwarven Agitators and Mercenaries and Blue Mountain Commandos, Dolblethana Marksmen, and Vreehead Brigades. But he's swapped out Sheldon Skaggs, who you love and who I love, for, I believe, Ida Amin, just to have that weather clear for the Gold Weather matchup, because Gold Weather still hurts movement, even though, you know, we do have the Vryhead Brigades in there. And so it's in a good place, I think. And sort of the way the game plan works is, you're right, you do want to sort of either bleed them out round one and get them to spend their tempo to try to counter your gold weather if you happen to have drawn it, which is pretty good. You run Yavin in there as well to take advantage of a coin flip situation or to draw yourself a gold weather or a Skelga Storm or Hailstorm, depending on what kind of list you have. But Yavin's perfect for this list because not only do you get to play into weather and then manipulate him and then cut him in half with Marigolds, but he guaranteed draws you either a gold weather or Marigolds. It's just amazing. He's a great spy to have in this deck because of the way he works. He draws you a spell, and you know what? Drought is a spell. You generally just get your Blue Mountain Commandos out, and you start more or less just developing some value in round one, and try to force them out with weather. And they know that round one's going to be very hard to win because you have Marigolds. And Broover-Hoog is typically the leader for movement because of his abilities to get out someone like Barclay Elves if you happen to be running him, or to get any other silver unit you might need in case you really need Yavin because you didn't draw gold weather. So, you know, there's a lot you can do with this deck. And like I said, it's very fun to just kind of play and move everybody around and watch the buffs happen because you have Blue Mountain Commandos and your Dolbathana Marksman's working really, really well with movement. And the lock target for this deck is Dolbathana Marksman. Don't let them go crazy.
They will go crazy, yeah. And yeah, by the way, I just want to just sound my love for Sheldon Skaggs. People have been calling him Sheldon Scraps in the past, but you know, even in the last meta, I actually tried to find decks where he might actually work because Blue Mountain Commandos have stayed the same, and it is greedy, right? It is, and I like that Marigold's Hailstorm Chicken. That's so perfect. That's such a perfect way to put it. And you know, it's just it looks like you're playing into it, but you're not really. You're actually trying to play as greedy as you possibly can with Sheldon Skaggs, like the king of greed. But Broover being the leader of movement, that is true. And I think that all the leaders have some great decks. Broover also can be the leader in the Marauder Full Moon deck, potentially. I think you might have multiple leader choices in that, because I think that it is kind of hybrid between spells and dwarf. And then you have your pure spell stuff that's out right now with Ethna. Now, they take advantage of the Farseer a lot. They also take advantage of Golden Weather a lot, and Hailstorm as well. But it's more about pushing your opponent out of the round with Gold Weather, but instead of controlling them through movement and having crazy long rounds that way, more so having maybe you have interaction with your opponent's board through spells, but you also have the passive generation of your Farseers growing up. And I feel like most of the time for me, spells is in a little bit of a weaker state because I feel like it just feels a little bit more clunky to me. I don't know if anybody's had the same experience with spell decks, but I feel like if it doesn't really kind of line up, it's not as fluid as movement can feel, or even Mulligan in some cases. Anybody played spell? Jagras, have you played spell Scoytel at all in this patch?
I've dabbled with it, but I agree with you in that it is a bit more clunky, especially if you lose the coin flip, you know, if you're having to go first, because a lot of your plays can be quite reactive. That makes life a bit trickier. Whereas with movement, you can always play your commandos, or you can play a marksman and just sacrifice the 2 points of damage. That's not a big loss. Or you can even open with the gold weather roach combo a lot of people are kind of running now, where, you know, if you play gold weather, it pulls roach from your deck, which gives you then points on the board. So you could just straight open with weather, and that means that if your opponent just passes on you, you just win the round. You don't have to then play a second card, which is often the case if you don't have roach. So it feels a little bit more, like I say, a little bit more clunky, and it, because it's such a kind of reactive deck, it's not as consistent if you're going first.
Yeah, I think that spells sort of, I've dabbled with it as well. I've seen a couple lists out there that actually don't run sages, and just run a few more spells instead. And I think that I still like sages in my lists. And the point for me is with your spells, they're a means to an end. They're not your win condition. Your win condition is your Dolbathana Protectors, but that's your round three win condition. And Ethna and using Alzar's Double Cross or Marching Orders to get them out, depending on what you have. That's why a lot of people have removed Sage as well. So for me, it's kind of like I like to use Farseers round one as, you know what, in round one, pretty early, no one's passing very early. You can lay these guys down and they're not a big threat at 8 power, right? But then they, as you said earlier, they extend the power of all of your spells, and your spells then become your means to an end of winning round one, because if they didn't handle your Farseers early enough, you can't Thunder these things. They're 8, right? And you have to lock them. And if you don't lock them, they're going to get out of hand. And so that's sort of your round one win condition. And then that still preserves your round three win condition with gigantic, hopefully, Dolblethana protectors. So I think that Farseers are huge in this deck, and they're very important to round one. And yeah, the spells aren't really as important as they are simply your ammo to get towards victory.
Yeah, I mean, the Sage allows you multiple spell instances as well. Ithlien can also do that as well. One of the decks that I tried out was Ithlien using Quen on your Sage. You use one on your Farseer and one on your Protector. Yep. So basically, like, the bulk of your deck is all protected against, you know, some of them might be protected against Hailstorm, but generally are protected against any sort of pings or damaging effects. And, you know, it's, I think that there's a couple of variations. You don't have to play Sages, but you could. You do probably have to play Protectors, though. That is, you know, it's one of the few cards that kind of survive the kind of sort of snowball in your hand, like whenever X happens, this boosts sort of thing. Like pirate captains have changed, the riot brigades have changed, the spotters have all changed. Like they work differently while still being kind of power bronzes, but the Dolblethana protectors are kind of like the remaining last bastion of your entire strategy up until this point. Like, my strength level is based on how you played the game previously to this. And I do like that. I think that it's worth one of those cards sticking around. And I think that with the protector starting at 2, that's fair. And, you know, with Ithlien no longer being able to play Rally twice, they feel a little bit reined in. And, you know, with the way the control meta is different now, I think that it feels good, but sometimes it's not always like a surefire thing. So it's in a good spot, I think. I like spell okay. But I've also been playing, the last one we can talk about is Francesca deck. So Francesca, I know, near and dear to you, I'm sure, Jagras, as that is also your name.
Yeah, she's the one true leader. I have a lot of love for Francesca. I was so happy at the start of this patch before the hotfix when, you know, you just had to make an elf deck. Just search elf, put those cards in, and Francesca was just kind of queen. I think she's still in a good place with her ability. I think the targeted mulligan is, you know, it's always going to be a useful ability, and there's always going to be decks that kind of work with her. I feel like she's almost like a flavor leader. Like, you can choose to play her if you fancy that ability, but, you know, if you want to go for something more geared towards spell or movement, then you could go Bruva or Ithne. I'm seeing a little bit of mulligan every so often, these kind of mulligan hybrid decks I've been seeing, kind of a little bit mulligan, a little bit boost. I don't feel like they're particularly great, but, you know, they're getting played, so clearly somebody likes them.
Yeah,
I've been enjoying... Yeah, go for it.
No, I mean, we've been doing the way we've been doing it for the entire episode, I guess. I'll continue following up. I think that sort of the short shrift we're giving Mulligan is that it isn't around as much anymore, and that was, like, you know, pointed straight at the nerfs of the Vreehead Officer specifically, I think. And you know, Elven War Dancers are a huge part of this deck too, but I really like the I still really like the deck, and I think that Vreehead Officers are still really good. You see them, you know, mulliganing Yavin, they're 16, you know, they can mulligan a couple of your silver ambush cards that keep Isengrim enabled. So that's sort of a good combo to pop off in this particular deck. And, you know, if you accidentally draw Morin or Truvial or both and you're holding Isengrim, usually Isengrim's kind of bricked. But with Mulligan, you know, officers can benefit from that by buffing themselves up to 10 or 11 points and also enabling your gold card. So, I mean, I think this deck doesn't have, like, a very, very defined win condition. It seems more reactive than anything else, and usually these decks are also running Marigold, so they kind of can out-tempo you at the same time, but I don't think they really threaten round three as badly as they do round one.
Yeah, it's interesting because of the state in the meta where, like, big bomb, big, like, gigantic units, they aren't quite the same. Like, we've seen, like, a real pullback. Like, we're not seeing a lot of Tibor anymore. We're not seeing a lot of Hjalmar anymore. Unseen Elder isn't even the pick for consume right now. Dagon appears to be kind of the champion there. So it's like the big cards, like this Francesca deck, like the way you play it with Mulligan, however you configure it, it has a lot of potential in a long round, especially if you're mulliganing Vanguards, you're boosting your whole board. You might be playing like something like a Farseer or maybe even a Hawker Smuggler to kind of keep your tempo higher than your opponent. But ultimately, when all the mulligan is said and done, what is your round three look like? And, like, big, scary gold cards, like, it doesn't really... it doesn't really hold the same power these days. And there are cards like Elias, which isn't seeing a lot of play, that can sort of get to that point if you are able to draw them. But, you know, with cards like Saskia and cards like Francesca specifically, and all the mulligan you do, like, it's really, really hard to not have the best hand you possibly can have. So it's really interesting in that you have so much control over the hand you have, the sequence of play. Some of the power plays, like the Vriad Officer, still hit 16 if you mulligan Yavin. And, you know, that's still like a huge, huge play that I've really enjoyed when I've been playing Francesca decks. But it's like that last little bit, that last little push in round three. You make good use in the short round in some cases, like if you are able to mulligan Yavin. But sometimes you're just kind of stuck with a Vriad Vanguard and maybe a 10-strength gold card, and you have to hope that that's enough. So I feel like it's an aggressive deck that can win round one really easily. But overall, I feel like it's definitely waned in popularity lately. But I still think it's strong, and I enjoy playing it, and I don't mind seeing it either.
You know where they are good? For beginners, because beginners have Geralt in a lot of their decks, and he's a 13-point gold card. So if you mulligan him, I believe you get 13 points on your whatever.
That's true.
Yeah, so I've seen that actually a lot of people mulliganing. It's weird. You would have thought, like, you want to play Geralt, but the mulligan Geralt is apparently a pretty good beginner strategy because it utilizes the gold cards that you have. So when you're a very new player, that's actually quite an effective strategy against other new players. So maybe Francesca is just, like, for now, she's a noob's best friend.
Yeah, I mean, one thing about, and we see this with spotters as well, being able to use Geralt in the hand, like, they will always be, Geralt will always usually be, like, the highest strength card in your hand, outside of maybe, like, Gengifret. I'm talking about Squirtle now, so, you know, there's nothing really higher strength card that you'll have in your hand that isn't Geralt Vanilla. So even though he's 13 strength with no effect, he does actually have synergy with some cards very, very specifically, and that's good, so Geralt isn't completely, like, obscure to some of the other gold cards.
No, I mean, there's a place for a 13 power gold. Just it's hard, and I think I'll wrap this up, Jaggerus, with a really what I think is a pretty solid question about the state of gold cards in the game, because you've been playing for a long time, and, you know, I know that you played Witcher sort of after finding Gwent, but those of us who have started with Gwent, gold cards were immune, and they were immune to everything, especially, you know, well, weather, I guess, in the original Witcher 3 Gwent. So, the, you know, having Geralt be something that you can, you know, buff your spotters with and Vriad Officers and that kind of thing is new, because gold cards are now interactive. So can you kind of give us your thoughts on the interactivity of gold cards? Because that is a huge change. It's probably one of the biggest changes we've had in Gwent.
Definitely compared to Witcher Gwent, because that was, you know, that's been a thing for a long time. I think that the reason they made the change was to make things a lot easier for new players, because ultimately you have to care about your new player retention, right? Like, CDPR are a business, and first impressions matter, and the state that the game was previously, I think it was very confusing for new players. Like, a lot of new players didn't understand the whole you can't target golds thing. I know friends, for example, who started playing and didn't realize that. And then you make misplays because you think you can do something with your cards that you can't. And then when that happens, you then feel kind of frustrated because you don't feel like it was ever really explained to you. And I feel like maybe a solution would have been to explain it, but instead they kind of took it away. And I think it's harmed a lot of cards that are not deployability cards, you know, like Yennefer, like Ciri, like Ciri Dash, like Triss Butterfly. There's a lot of cards that have been kind of harmed by it. And I think it's also one of the symptoms of our current Marigold's Hailstorm meta, in that now everything is targetable, so Marigold's gets a lot more value. I don't know. I feel like gold immunity would be good selectively on specific cards. I think immunity as a feature would just be good selectively on cards, and I'm hoping maybe they'll bring it back. I'm not entirely against the change. I think it's kind of, you know, completely changed things up, and that's always good. But I feel like it's not quite where it needs to be in terms of the state of the game.
Yeah, I remember, and I feel like the gold immunity thing has been something that's kind of always been in the background as, like, an issue, but never really perceived as an issue because of how long-standing Gwent has just been gold cards are immune. And one of the things, since we were talking about Vanilla Geralt, one of the very first, like, super weird interactions that was, like, incredibly confusing for new players and for even people who just kind of wanted to see the game work in a certain way way, way back, I'm not sure if you were playing around at this time, Jagras, but way back, potions had a different effect on witchers. They had an amplified effect. So if you used a Thunderbolt potion on the three witchers, Vesemir, Lambert, and Eskel, they would get more of a boost. But you couldn't actually use potions on Geralt, which is the witcher that every player gets for free. So you couldn't actually buff Geralt with potions that were specifically designed for a witcher because you couldn't buff gold cards. So it was like an incredibly unintuitive thing that would have actually been solved immediately if you could just buff gold cards. So it's interesting. Like, I feel like that problem was already sort of like kind of in the background of that issue, and like other kind of like promote became an issue because of the uninteractivity with gold cards and how strong it was to make a card gold. All of these issues could have, like, if they decided to make this change to gold cards earlier in the life cycle and the balancing phase of Gwent, we could end up with cards that do completely different things because it would have solved future problems at different time periods. So like a card that may have felt too strong because of the state of golds of, you know, first quarter 2017, that maybe that interaction wouldn't have been looked at, because I feel like we see there is some sort of like a legacy effect on some of these cards that are balanced for a world where golds are immune that maybe haven't caught up or maybe can be looked at again kind of in a new world. And we'll probably see golds designed in the future basically kind of on a blank page state where golds are now immune now. Now let's design some new gold cards. So future golds may be more interesting than ever. That's what I'm hoping for. That's great. I'm glad we talked about that, because it still remains to be a hot topic because it is still very new in this season.
Yeah, and specifically, I think that Jagras, you had mentioned that you worked or at least spoken closely with Merchant, and that's something that he's been talking about, and I've been listening. I think that's a solid idea to think about some cards getting immunity back, but certainly not for all, because the interactivity of Gwent is going to be something that I think people find the most fun, or at least the most understandable, and having a bunch of anchors sitting in the middle of your board, these golden anchors, isn't necessarily what they want, and I completely agree with the fact that it's better for the game probably, and certainly better for newer players.
Jagras, it's been great having you on the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us today for episode 52. We'd like to ask you a question that we ask all of our guests. Could you please describe the Commander's Horn Studio as it appears in your mind's eye? What would this imaginary room look like to you?
It's full of dogs, isn't it? It's just, it's you and me and loads of like dogs just sleeping kind of everywhere, just chilling out, having a good time. They're very good dogs. They haven't interrupted us once. I think that's definitely the Commander's Horn. That was in my dream's eye, so I guess that counts as my mind's eye. So, yeah, and they're all really cute as well.
And your favorite favorite breed of dog?
Oh, that's a toughie. That's a.
We
toughie.
Gotta know what to fill the studio with.
Well, we're gonna just fill the studio with this kind of dog. Probably like a Brittany, like they're kind of like spanielish looking dogs, but they're big. They can run. They got floppy ears. They're super cute.
Agreed.
So good. Your number one Gwent / dog podcast.
Your Gwent dog cast.
Jagras. Jagras, where can people find you and your Gwent content out there?
Okay, well, I'm on YouTube, youtube.com/Jagras. It's so easy for all of your deck guides and discussion and all that kind of thing. Also, That Witcher Let's Play. Then on Twitch, twitch.tv/Jagras, unsurprisingly. That is usually afternoons CEST, European time. And on Twitter, @Jagras. I'm like the easiest person to follow because all of my handles are the same.
Jagras, it was great to meet you. Great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for stopping by. And hopefully we will talk to you soon.
It's been fantastic. Thanks for having me.
So great to have Jagras join us. Thanks so much to her for that. And we would also like to thank our commandos right about now, because we are supported by our commandos.
Commandos!
Our patrons at patreon.com/commandershorn. Thanks once again for supporting our content, keeping the podcast ad-free, keeping us coming back week after week to proudly represent the community with the best content we can produce. And we have a great couple of emails that came into the commandershornpodcast@gmail.com. And one of those is Feral265. Very simple question. How much Gwent do we play in a day? Greyboxer, how often do you play Gwent? And how long is a typical session for you?
Well, it depends. And that's something that I think that I've talked about with the commandos in the Discord channel a few times. And I have this sort of odd way of approaching ranked with anxiety. And with casual mode being a complete ghost town anymore, everyone's playing either ranked or pro ladder, it seems like. I can never find a match in casual to play around. So when I play, I like to play ranked mode. And I like to play until I go on a losing streak. And anybody who's ever bet before knows to stop betting when you've lost a few in a row, not to dig yourself any deeper. So that's kind of the way I play Gwent. If I go on a nice win streak, I like to keep riding it out. But if I start losing a few in a row, I just go ahead and sign off and, you know, play Witcher 1 or go read a book or something. I go do something outside. Sometimes that means I can play 25 or 30 games in a day. Sometimes I play 4.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm about, like, because I stream and I play, and I stream most days, I usually get about 4 or 5 hours in. And I think I play about, like, 20, 25 games in that time. You know, because there's some chatting as well, and, you know, there's, like, you know, stuff happens during the stream. But I think about 20, 25 is about a session. That's a good session. If I play off stream, I feel like whatever I can fit into an hour, hour and a half is about it for me. But I do play every day, so there is that. Thanks so much, Farrell, for writing in. We have another email here from DG Thunderer, friend of the show. He wanted to share some stuff about coin flips. Did you want to read this one?
Yeah, this is a pretty good one. I actually really enjoyed this email. Thanks for sending in, DG Thunderer. We have talked a lot on this podcast about the coin flip, and everyone talks about the coin flip all the time, ever since it came out a few months ago that, you know, everybody started to figure out that as the game balances out and factions are more balanced in their representation, Skellige jokes aside, there's a fine line between being able to win a game and losing a game based on something as simple as a coin flip, and everybody's talking about it. So DG kind of sends a little bit of perspective to us. He wants to put his own two cents in about the coin flip. And DG Thunderer writes, "The thing that stuck out to me most about coin flips was when I first found a matchup where it was actually beneficial to go first. Not better to go first, but the benefit significantly mitigated the punishment. The first matchup I found was in the NR mirror, where Kedwini Siege supports were crucial and only 4 strength. If you played your Kedwini Siege supports first, you could then kill your opponents with the reinforced ballista since they were a crewman." DG continues, "While I'm not sure if they could ever make it so that it's actually better to go first, I think that they can look to include a lot more of these types of things to mitigate the coin flip. First, they need to have more units that require setup. So, like the Kedwini Siege supports, maybe like the Skellige War longships. Then they need to give those units control damage instead of random damage." And he thinks that the Nilfgaardian Enforcer is an excellent example of this. And he'd like to see CD Projekt Red focus on this kind of thing first before just sort of throwing a solution at us. So I really like that perspective, DG, and I think that you bring up a really good point, and you give people some good information that, hey, there is a time when going first is maybe not advantageous, but it's at least beneficial. And those are the kind of cards that you want to have in your deck if you're really worried about the coin flip. Like, I think Nilfgaardian Enforcers are pretty good, except that, you know, on deploy, they still have a damage effect, so maybe they're not that perfect for going first with. And so even though they have targeted damage, I think that's what DG's looking for. But yeah, I think it's... I like to hear a reasoned discussion about the coin flip, but I mean, the point is we're in a beta right now, but the beta kind of feels like a real game. It feels like a released game. And we were talking about this in the regular Discord, the Gwent general Discord. And because it's a sort of... You're qualifying for real tournaments for real money on the pro ladder, that implementing a huge change to coin flip on the live server is going to be problematic because it's going to turn the ladder on its head, especially since the guys at the top are the ones who are most clamoring for a change to coin flip. So I think that we're sort of in this position right now, McBeard, where we do need to see a change. It needs it to be soon, but maybe the PTR is the right place for that, is sort of where I'd take this. And I'd like to see some of the things that DG is talking about, like maybe changing a few cards around and making sure that they look like they fit in most decks in order to combat the coin flip.
Yeah, and I think what DG Thunder is saying is that I think he's the kind of player who really likes a good proactive card. So a card that you're happy to play first. Like Full Test is a card like that. Like he can be very slow when you play him. So it's good if you can play him first in some situations. Or setting up Trebuchets, setting up your Kedwini Siege supports. And of course the things that ping. Those are basically setting up yourself for the future of the round. And that is something that your opponent would have to immediately have a counter for. Or, you know, you can benefit from that setup, because setting up early is better than setting up late, because you want to get as much value as you can out of those cards. And, you know, they can be slow sometimes if you can't really maximize their potential. So as far as more proactive plays coming into the game and more decisions on, you know, this card would be really good to go first with, like if they can make cards that make people say that, that would definitely ease the pain, I think, because you'd be happy to go first. You know, Savage Bear feels like a card like that as well. Like it reacts to what your opponent does. So having it out there first is, you know, a good card. So, or it used to be a good card, I guess. You don't really see it very often anymore, but, you know, it's just, I feel like it just fits the example, but yeah, thanks GG for writing. We are, you know, we're always looking forward to the next piece of Gwent news, the next content, pack that's going to come in, the next bits of changes, the UI improvements. Every patch has brought us this wealth of stuff. One of these days, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be coin flip addressing. And one of these days, you know, single player is going to come out, and there's still so many good things that are going to come out. So yeah, and the game's so good right now. So once they just further little tweaks here, I think we're at the little tweak phase.
Well, I mean, I would argue that a coin flip change is probably not a little tweak, but I think that making more proactive cards like Farseer and Hawker Smuggler are really good, and they are a step in the right direction. And I hope those are the kind of things that DG wants to continue to see.
Right on. Thanks so much for joining us. Great show today. You can follow us on Twitter for all updates about the show at Commander's Horn. And feel free once again to email us with questions, concerns, discussion topics at commandershornpodcast@gmail.com. Gray Boxer.
Yes, you can find me at GrayBoxerGwent on Twitter. You can find me as GrayBoxer on YouTube, and you can find me at twitch.tv/GrayBoxer. I stream at about, I want to say 3 a.m. CEST, but if you're in North America, then it's about 9 p.m., 10 p.m. On various random weeknights, I pretty much go up as often as I can.
Champion of the night. I can be found at McBeardCH on Twitter, McBearded on Twitch, and McBeard on YouTube. Thanks so much for joining us today, folks. See you next week for the Gwent Slam coverage.
Oh, yeah. And until next time, this is Gray Boxer.
And this is McBeard.
Best of luck.
On the path.